I have had a lot of fun putting this conference together. And the great fun has consisted, well, of many things. But to be brief about it, it's been talking to all of you over these many months. I say talking, but I mean, of course, emailing. The conference was built by hand, and it was built not because I knew who all of you were when I started this. I certainly did not. It was built by knowing one person, and then they say, you need to contact so-and-so, and they say, you need to contact so-and-so. And then I also called in a lot of old friends as well. Marcelo Gleiser is a very good example of the kind of the, how this conference was built. Marcelo was at the ITP, and I say ITP because many years ago, before the Kavli came to the title, it was the ITP, and was across campus on the sixth floor of a building with a very, very dangerous elevator. So Marcelo has a past with the KITP, but he was at the Cornelia Street Cafe in New York, a place that many of you know, and he met our conference participant, Mr. Einstein, and one thing led to another, and Marcelo ended up reading Jeremy's play, and Marcelo had the honor of being the first physicist to read Jeremy's play. Jeremy, in turn, told me about Marcelo. And I mentioned Marcelo's name to my wife, and she says, oh yes, Marcelo, I know Marcelo. And so I emailed Marcelo, would you be interested in the conference? Yes. So this has been the beauty of it, and that's just one example among many. Marcelo is professor of physics at Dartmouth. He's the author of The Dancing Universe, From Creation Myths to the Big Bang. He is the moderator of Writing Cosmology.
Thank you.
Marcelo?
Thanks very much. Well, I'll sit down, I guess. So I'm very proud of being the moderator of such a panel. You know, this is just great. You know, I've known Marcia for a long time. She was a postdoc at Fermilab, and it was, you know, just beginning, and she was there already, you know, at the fringes talking about cosmic strings and stuff. And what we plan to do is to be very brief. Each one of us will have a very brief statement, you know, we talked about 3 minutes or five, and the goal is to put some ideas on the table and then have the audience, you know, discuss with us. And so let me, I'm sure you've met all of us already, but let me again introduce, in case you just came in. I have here Alan Lightman, you know, who is an astrophysicist and a very distinguished nonfiction and fiction writer. I have Marcia Bartusek, who was just introduced, but I'll do it again. You know, she's teaching science writing at MIT graduate program. She's the author of 4 books, most recently the one which is a fantastic idea, was Archives of the Universe, which in which she basically put together the original texts, you know, from Ptolemy and Kepler, etc., Newton, to describe how our views of the universe changed in time. And then I have Sean Carroll, who is a professor at the University of Chicago and a fellow cosmologist, who has a fantastic distinction of not only having written a textbook while he was not tenured, but also but also have, I don't know how you pull this, you know, he also taught a course called The History of Atheism at the University of Chicago, and I think that's just fantastic. And then last but not least, I have Jenna, whom I've also known for a very long time. She is a professor at Barnard College now and an astrophysicist, and she has written this book, which is a wonderful book called How the Universe Got Its Spots, and she has something coming out, which is a nameless book apparently for now, but promises to be really interesting. Okay, so to the panel itself. The title of this panel is Writing Cosmology. And I love the title because I find it has a double meaning, because you could say writing about cosmology, you know, so how do we write about cosmology to people who are not you know, working with cosmology. But there's another interpretation, which is the one I think we should explore here more, which is writing cosmology. which really means, you know, being part of a very old tradition, which is that since the beginning of civilization, you know, we had to be outside in the world and we tried to make meaning of the world and we tried to translate what we saw into some kind of narrative. And so the oldest things that put us together, in a sense, as a culture, are creation myths. Myths that describe somehow how the universe came to be, how something came out of nothing, you know, which is one of perhaps most complicated questions you can ask, right? How is that possible? So different cultures came up with different ideas, you know, and of course Genesis is a very popular one. There are many others. For example, the Maori Indians of New Zealand say that nothing came out of nothing. There was no God, no goddess, nothing, and suddenly, just from the urge to exist, the universe popped out. You know, so sort of, which is a good thing, because there's some modern theories that say very similar things about cosmology. But the point here is that I think writing cosmology, in a sense, is the way in which we use the conceptual framework of science nowadays to be part of this old cultural tradition of making sense of the world and who we are. And so back to the question that the former panel talked about, which is why is it that cosmology is so appealing to the general public as opposed to condensed matter physics, for example. And I think the key reason for that is because it is part of this tradition in which we try to understand who we are, and it's a very big question. It's a question that's much older than science is. It's a question that has to do with religion originally, right? And that has been transformed through science into cutting edge research stuff, but it's something that people want to know more than about transistors or other things. So I think there is a very deep reason for that. It's a reason that cosmologists, in a sense, are following on the footsteps of meaning-making people, okay? And the other thing quickly I wanted to make a point of, and I hope the panel will address this, is that whenever you're doing cutting edge science, there's a lot of stuff that we don't know if it's right or if it's wrong, you know. And so, for example, we dream of ideas such as multiverses, you know, or 10, 11 dimensional theories, which may or may not be right. And it's the role of these ideas, you know, in the creative process of the scientist, similar to the role of myth making, you know, in general cultures, and how effective this is. And do we need these things? If we don't have these things, you know, we just don't go forward, in a sense. You know, Kepler had the dream that everything was geometry, and because of that dream, he came up with these laws of planetary motion, which almost embarrassing because they don't quite fit in this geometric framework that he had, but still, so the dream kind of was the thing that pushed him forward. So I will stop now, and I'll just let's go down. There's no order here, you know. Let's just go down, I guess, from here on. Alan, please.
Well, I think this is a very exciting time period of history to be writing about cosmology, because modern cosmology is a fairly young science, just started in 1917 with Einstein's theory of general relativity, actually his cosmological model. And new instruments in the last decade have allowed us to make huge advances in cosmology, particularly by measuring the radio waves that are left over from the Big Bang to very high accuracy with satellites above the Earth's atmosphere. We've been able to learn a tremendous amount about cosmology. And what's so exciting to me is even though we have made great advances, we have uncovered enormous puzzles that have the cosmologists themselves and the physicist without any explanation. And I just wanted to mention two of those puzzles. One is that we know that most of the matter, there's a large amount of matter in the universe that we can't see and we don't know what it is. We have indirect evidence of it from its gravitational effects. It's called dark matter. And this is a large percentage of the total mass of the universe, much more than the matter we see is the matter we don't see, and we don't know what it is. We have no idea what it is. The other huge puzzle is, as some of you know, is that in the last few years we have discovered observationally that there is an anti-gravitational force, which is called dark, it's represented as dark energy, as a term that's sometimes used to describe it. But it's a repulsive gravitational force, and its magnitude, when expressed in terms of its equivalent mass, is about the same as the amount of matter that we don't see, the dark matter. And why? First of all, we don't know exactly what causes the dark energy. And second of all, we are totally perplexed as to why its amount should be approximately equal to the amount of the dark matter. There's no theoretical understanding of why those two amounts should be the same. They're both things that we don't see, that we just have indirect evidence of. So there's something really strange going on, or something beautiful that we don't understand about modern cosmology. And I think this is when scientists are the most excited, when there's something that they don't understand. When you look at some of the great revolutions in science, for example, they're always preceded, almost always preceded by a period of being stumped over a problem and not having any explanation, knowing that there's something that we don't understand. For example, when we knew that in 1900 that atoms, hot atoms, emitted light at only certain frequencies, and those certain frequencies had certain patterns, like certain musical notes on a scale, but we had no understanding of why they had those patterns. That was also a period like today with cosmology, where it was a tremendously stimulating confusion, and that's the confusion we have right now with cosmology, and people who work on it are very excited that there's this vast stuff that we don't understand, and maybe there will be a conceptual breakthrough sometime in our lifetimes.
I was going to make similar remarks. Marcelo mentioned cosmology being one of our oldest endeavors, and actually I think of it as one of the newest endeavors. Alan briefly mentioned that also, because until around the early 1900s, cosmology was really a philosophical pursuit. There were some observations. They saw these little fuzzy nebulae in the sky, and there was speculation whether they were other island universes. But it was just that. It was speculation. And then there was this great moment. It was the perfect storm in some ways, both with Einstein introducing his theory of general relativity and the introduction of the great telescopes, the 100-inch telescope at Mount Wilson, which enabled Edwin Hubble and Milton Humason to discover not only that there were other galaxies, but they were fleeing outward in a specific way, which indicated that the universe was indeed expanding, that the universe was something far different than had ever been imagined before. That was really the start of modern cosmology, was that moment in which you had a mathematical set of equations that could physically describe and make predictions about the nature and structure of the universe. It was no longer just your imagination of coming up with schemes, mythical, legendary schemes on how the universe came about. And from that point forward, there has been a sort of really a forward march of studying the universe both through astronomical observations and, as Alan pointed out, the exquisite look at the microwave background, the remnant echo, the remnant radiation that is now filling the universe from the primeval fireball. What I find interesting when you look back at history with various cosmological models, first we had Ptolemy with his crystalline spheres. And though we laugh about that now, it was actually a very powerful model which could make predictions about planetary movements, and then it was stretched too far. It started breaking down, and lo and behold, Copernicus stepped in to bring a simplification and a better understanding and a whoa moment of, yes, that makes much better sense to have the sun in the center. And then that was carried through until it sort of stretched the point of observations, when we always thought we were the center of the Milky Way, and then observation showed, no, that was not true. We were actually pushed off to the side. And then with Hubble, the Milky Way galaxy itself was just one of many billions of other galaxies. There are these sort of leaps of always changing our model. And I wanted to bring this up. I feel like we're at this critical moment when you start having to call things dark matter, dark energy. That's a big flashing sign. Something's wrong with this model. And I really wonder if we're at a moment at which we're going to have not just an added detail to our cosmological model, but is this a signal that maybe we're going to have to change our model altogether? Of course, we don't know. It may fizzle out in the end to just another extension in a minor way, but is it the indication of something else? It just, you know, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, I get very uncomfortable as a writer when I have to describe things in terms of dark matter, dark energy. It's a real sign to me, having that historic perspective of having just gone through the whole history of astronomy, that it sounds like something else is at work here. And I'm very excited to be in an era where there may be another big shift in our thoughts about what the universe is really like.
I just want to make a quick comment on that. What promotes all these astronomical revolutions, as you said, what happened, for example, in the Renaissance was data. It was data-driven. It was Tycho Brahe, you know, that had the best data possible that made possible for Kepler to come up with his new things. And that, in that sense, cosmology sort of came of age, because it's not a data-driven science, which was not the case 25 years ago.
And now there's this union between cosmology, the science of the universe at large, with the microcosm. I think the mystery of the dark matter may truly be found in new particle physics, with theories that at this moment are telling us that there may be additional particles of matter surrounding us that are only really seen through their gravitational force, but don't interact with us very deeply through any other force, and why they have been so difficult to detect at this moment. So that's a new, actually, era of cosmology, is in the sense we've united the macrocosm with the microcosm in a beautiful way. And it's very interesting to observe the interaction of the particle physics with the cosmologists. And this is something that has really just been generated over the last 20 years. And that's an exciting new area of cosmology.
Sean? So I think if this conference were arbitrarily long, it would be fun to have more short talks about actual science. We're going to get Joe Polchinski is going to explain quantum electrodynamics to us, so I'm looking forward to that. But and there's all sorts of wonderful topics that, as we say, are source material for literary adventures, and we could, you know, have discussions about entropy and the arrow of time and all these wonderful things. But what I thought about, I would mention today, is actually something that is not so much on the cutting edge, something we actually understand. One of the things that we which is the expansion of the universe. Einstein, as has just been mentioned, figured out general relativity in the 19-teens, and general relativity says that what you and I think of as gravity is a manifestation of the curvature of space-time. And one way that space-time can be curved is that the universe can expand. We have an equation that tells us how the universe expands. If you have certain kinds of stuff, we might be confused about the stuff, but the expansion is something we actually understand at the level of equations, it fits the data very, very well. When, as scientists, we try to explain certain things to the public or to writers or journalists, sometimes we have trouble articulating what we're saying because we are confused. When we talk about dark energy, we don't know what it is. When we talk about string theory or quantum mechanics, part of our imperfect communication is that there's imperfect thing that we are trying to communicate. However, for the expanding universe is not like that. We understand it basically perfectly. I could write down the equations. If you ask me a question about what will happen under certain circumstances, I can give you the answer. Nevertheless, it is hard to make people understand what is going on if they don't have those equations. There is something of a language barrier, for example. And I think that one of the things that we have to recognize is that we typically don't invent new words out of whole cloth when we talk about new scientific achievements. We borrow words from the pre-existing language. And when we use words like energy or expansion or dimension or dark, these words have pre-existing meanings. And one of the problems with the concept, like when we say, well, 70% of the universe is dark energy, the problem with that, one of the problems with that statement is not that no one knows what dark energy is, but that people think they have an idea of what it might be on the basis of their pre-existing experience with darkness and energy. And they're not right. And one of my proudest moments as a science popularizer was when I gave a talk on dark energy, and I got a question from the audience that was, a woman in the back raised her hand and said very politely, I'm very impressed with this 70% of the universe's dark energy. Do you think that this concept of dark energy could have any connection with the Chinese concept of qi energy? And I said, well, the dark energy, I mean, it's easy, it would be very tempting to say no. So I did, but I prefaced it with the actual explanation. I said, you know, dark energy, the only thing we know about dark energy is that it's perfectly smooth, not evolving in space or time, not interacting with any of the particles that we know and love. So whatever dark energy is, it does not have any way to influence human behavior in any way, and therefore I do not think it is the Chinese concept of qi energy. I think it's actually the right answer, but she had a perfectly legitimate question. It's not at all a bad question. You know, I've heard of kinds of energy before. Could we use dark energy to, you know, free ourselves from dependence on foreign oil sources is another perfectly good question. But, okay, but the expansion of the universe is, no. For exactly the same reason. We can't do anything. It's the most useless kind of energy there is. Ask about black holes is a different question, but dark energy, no.
If it can't do work, is it energy?
It provides employment for cosmologists. What else do we need from dark energy? But the fact that the universe is expanding is something that even the students in my graduate general relativity class struggle with. Even though they can do the equations, they'll ask a question like, well, if the universe is expanding, does that mean that I'm expanding? And I can say no, or I can say, you know, if you are expanding, it's not because of the expansion of the universe, it's because of, you know, the muffins at the coffee brand. But they don't quite buy it, you know, until they work through the equations themselves, because it's hard to explain what that means, because it's not something that we deal with in our everyday human interactions. So a couple days ago, I was promoting the idea that science is a wonderful source material for metaphors to help us think about everyday human life. Today I would like to just lament the fact that everyday human life is terrible source material for metaphors to help us understand science sometimes. And the expanding universe is a really good example. It's really tempting when you talk about the expanding universe to appeal to different metaphorical analogies. The favorite one being the balloon, and there's little dots on the surface of the balloon is expanding. And I hate that analogy for the expanding universe, because the scientist who gives it says, okay, you have a balloon and it's expanding and the dots are moving apart and that's like the universe. But the inside of the balloon, so pretend that's not there. And the whole universe is just the balloon. But no one to whom you give this analogy can successfully pretend that the inside of the balloon is not there. They think that there's, and they say, well, what is expanding away from? What is it expanding into? And you're like, why are you asking me these questions? And they should say, because you gave me such a bad metaphor that it's not at all like the universe. And what I've tried to do is actually to explain the expansion of the universe by being resolutely non-metaphorical and saying, imagine you're standing outside on a clear night and you can see everything in the universe with perfect precision and you can take the spectra with your eyes perfectly well. You would see that there are galaxies and each galaxy has a trillion stars in it and all the galaxies are moving away from us. And if you just close your eyes and imagine this happening, all the galaxies have a distance between them that is increasing. That's the expansion of the universe. And there's no referent to things outside the expanding universe, and I don't know whether this works. This is what I attempt to do. I think it removes certain things. The other famous metaphor or analogy is the raisin bread. You put the raisin bread in, but raisin bread has a crust and it's in an oven, and none of those things are true for the universe.
How do you get around them thinking they're the center of the universe with that everything flying away from them?
Well, in practice, what I do is I say, okay, now imagine that you are one of those galaxies, what would you see? Well, you would see us moving away just as fast. Everyone, I think that you can at least make the claim, whether or not they buy it, that everyone in this universe, as we call it, would see a similar thing. But I'm not putting this forward because I think it's the right answer, because I have a track record of miserable failure when it comes to explaining the concept of extra dimensions of space. And I would love it if someone would help me explain this concept of extra dimensions. So, you know, I use the metaphors. I talk about the garden hose and the ant and the tightrope and the straw and all those things. And I remember I was on live radio once being interviewed and about extra dimensions, and I gave this little explanation of what I think extra dimensions would be in terms of the garden hose or whatever. And the host said, I'm not sure I quite get that. Could you explain that again in a different way? And I said, no. I couldn't do it. I'm at a loss to explain this. And again, you know, once the equations are just not so hard. So I really don't know what to do in that case. I've tried Flatland. I said, well, imagine that we have one of our big dimensions and it's squeezed down so we became two-dimensional. Then there'd be a little, it doesn't seem to really go. I don't know. Maybe I'm just not patient enough. But so, it's a wonderful thing to think about how we can best explain these things that we actually do understand really well. I mean, then there's a whole other thing to think about, how we can explain the things that we're clueless about, like dark matter and the arrow of time and the multiverse and stuff like that. But it's, you know, it's, we've gotten people excited about it. We need to do a little bit better job of getting them informed about it.
Yeah. Well, I want to hearken back to something Marcella said about this being an ancient question. I really like that image, you know, and it's clearly true that we've been asking questions about cosmology ever since we could ask questions. And I think that there's something in that very idea that speaks about something about the universal human condition, and I'm not sure what it is exactly. Maybe somebody will have some insights. But it seems that, you know, a very long time ago, we clambered onto two legs, we started doing cave paintings, we started having imagination, we started talking about where we came from, and we started recording these ideas. And very far down the line, we have these very elaborate civilizations that begin to think that they're great. You know, we're great. Human beings are the center of the universe, and that's something Marcia brought up. So we become not just, you know, we go from, you know, being on all fours to standing on two legs to having cave paintings to thinking we are the center of the universe. And then a small group of people stand on the shore of the planet, look out into space, and do something that I think is really remarkable. They confess their insignificance. And they look out into space, not just at the clouds and not just at the atmosphere, but further to the stars and possibly even further, like Kant, which you also brought up, imagining galaxies, that these little smudges might actually be island universes. And we get to the point where we realize, looking into that depth, that really completely remarkable expanse of space, that we're not much. And that's, I think, a huge thing to confess. And as we get further and further along in our theories with Einstein and then with Alpha, who was brought up, and Hermann and and people to admit that maybe we're just an ashy residue of the Big Bang. We're just and especially now that we look at the constituents of the universe, and we realize that the material that we're made of is a minute fraction of what's out there. We're like a bit of leftover dust, essentially. And to have that admission, I think, is when we become great. So I love that bittersweet combination that we're able to say, We're not at the center of the universe, we're not at the center of the galaxy, we're not even at the center of the solar system. But that places us at the center of our stories, and I think that somehow this is why it makes such a great story. It's that combination of greatness and weakness, of significance and insignificance. And I think that's also what's so powerful in the great biographies of scientists. It's not people who have had flawless, simple lives, who traversed everything so easily and made their great achievements. Those are very dull stories. It's the combination of the two, and as in somebody like Kurt Gödel, who I brought up yesterday, who was a great genius, possibly the greatest logician since Aristotle, possibly greater than Aristotle, yet was a paranoid schizophrenic. It's that combination that's so amazing. It's the idea that greatness is doled out with an equal measure of weakness. And somehow I think that's intrinsic in our looking at the cosmos, in realizing what we are in the greater scheme of things. And I think that's why it lends itself to narrative and why it captures people's imaginations and why it's a question we've always needed to ask. We're looking somehow for meaning precisely in the admission that maybe we're just a little bit of dust. And that's also something I think that we talked about yesterday in one of the panels, that the idea that we're a bit of dust makes people feel nervous or anxious or insignificant or purposeless, and this quote of Weinberg's came up, and I actually think Steven Weinberg's quote that Alan brought up, which I'm not going to be able to reproduce perfectly, actually saying that there is less meaning in the universe as we discover more, I don't think it leaves out that possibility that in fact, again, that is precisely how we're finding our meaning, by making those honest admissions and looking at ourselves in the cold, hard light of the way things actually are. I think that's all I wanted to throw out there. In the spirit of keeping it brief.
I think it was a beautiful analysis of the fact that the more we see we are insignificant, the more, in some sense, the wonder of the accomplishment that we, with our tiny brain, can look out and come to this this concept. And I wonder, and I worry sometimes, whether with the new advances in cosmology showing that we've constantly been removing ourselves from the center of the universe, first from the solar system, the Milky Way, the universe, and now the universe itself, we're thinking maybe just one of other universes, that we see the wonder that we have accomplished this through our intellectual endeavors, yet I wonder if we're going to start facing the problems that the Darwinians are facing, in the sense that there is the creationism reaction. And is cosmology, in a sense, also going to have this reaction at some point, where people are reacting to the cosmological models the way they do against the Darwinian models? In fact, I'm amazed that it isn't brought more into the discussion.
I am too, actually, and Sean, I'm sure, is going to have something to say about this with his course on the history of atheism, but clearly cosmological models are somehow in competition, not necessarily in competition with religious models. I mean, I know religious cosmologists who somehow find a way to meld those things, but it is clearly saying that the religious model is not going to answer my questions. I'm going to continue to pursue questions to their fullest, and clearly a bend towards materialism emerges, I think, from these discussions. So I don't know why there hasn't been more outrage. Where's all the outrage?
You tried to propose an answer. I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I think the answer, at least in the minds of most people, is that unless cosmology can do away with the problem of first cause, you will always have room for religion, and you can build the most sophisticated model using quantum mechanics and general relativity and come up with a quantum cosmological way of describing the beginning of the universe. You always need an initial condition, you always need a way to make that thing pop into existence. And it is this thing which is completely, it's ingrained in the way science is done. We cannot get around that unless we invent a new kind of science, which we haven't. And we always will have room for people to say, aha, well, who determined the initial condition that created this universe we live in, And that's a real problem.
I would just say that sounds like a relatively sophisticated reasoning for why people don't have the reaction against cosmology they do against evolution. I think there's a couple more prosaic explanations. One is that the statement that the universe is 14 billion years old and came from a Big Bang affects us slightly less viscerally than the statement that our ancestors were monkeys. And people, you know, if you hear the actual rhetoric, that is what bothers a lot of people. There's an even more prosaic explanation, which is that cosmology is not taught in high schools in the same way that biology and evolution are. So what I would like to see happen is that everyone graduating from high school must be taught about the Big Bang, and then maybe there will be a reaction against it.
You're just dying for it.
I would love it.
Fortunately, meshes nicely with the let there be light in the Bible, and I think that's another thing, yes, that, with Maxwell's equations. And let there be light, so that people can accommodate, which is one reason the Catholic Church did not make a ruckus about the Big Bang, having the Galileo. They learned their lesson with Galileo because they felt they could accommodate it within the mythic structure of the Judeo-Christian writings, so that there's more of a mesh, I think.
There's a story about Stephen Hawking gave one of the earliest talks on quantum cosmology and the wave function of the universe at a conference that was sponsored by the Vatican in Rome, and the Pope gave the sort of closing remarks, and at which he said, I'm very happy that all you scientists are here. We've learned a lot about God's creation by studying the universe, and the only thing that you're not allowed to think about is where the universe came from. And apparently no one had told him that Hawking had given a talk on exactly that. So it might not be, it might be that Marcel is right, and that, people are certainly proposing models of the universe in which there is not an initial condition, and maybe that would start bugging people more, I don't know.
Well, I want to actually have a scientific digression, which is that I think that the fact that there are initial conditions in the way we model the Big Bang is clearly a mistake, and that we should be exactly as Sean just said, looking at models where either they somehow contain their own creation, like Richard Gott did, or even, and now I've got Gödel on the brain, but Gödelian structures are things where the very principle you're talking about contains itself, like the set of all sets or something like that. And so, I think that we should be thinking about models that are so self-referential that they contain themselves and their own laws, and therefore initial conditions must somehow also come out. But, I do think it's a shortcoming of the way we think. I think we think about it in a sort of, the intuition that the rest of the world also has, what was before. We're still thinking about it in that way as cosmologists.
Sure. Well, I think, as Sean alluded to, there are models, and one of them is due to Stephen Hawking in 1982, that, as you know, that don't need to specify initial conditions. And in fact, if quantum mechanics applies in the early universe, and we certainly think that it did, then there are the meaning of time itself ceases to exist in any way that we understand it now. That we now think that, at least speaking in the universe that we know about, there are three space dimensions and one time dimension. That if you go, if quantum effects start becoming important on the nature of space and time, which they would have at near the beginning of the universe in all models, that the time dimension does not behave like a time dimension that we're familiar with now, that it starts taking on characteristics of space dimensions, and the whole concept of time and a beginning lose their meaning in the language and understanding that we have now. So that's one way in which the question that we're asking about the initial conditions ceases to have meaning in the way that we're asking it.
He put it, it's as you're standing right at the North Pole. Where is North? That was the way Hawking put it in his book.
It's semantics, because he used boundary conditions, and that's really the same thing, honestly. I don't believe that's getting away from the problem. The way science is formulated, you cannot get away from this problem, at least, unless you do something revolutionary like what you're mentioning.
Well, aren't there cosmological schemes now where you have a continual inflation popping off in different areas so that that in a sense we're back to the steady state universe, but in a different way.
Right.
But then you can ask what would cause one particular region of space-time to inflate into a new universe. What was the quantum mechanical fluctuation that led to that? And you might be then get back to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, where even as a matter of principle, you cannot predict what would cause a given universe to come into being.
Right. This is great because we're talking about science, but and also because my most recent paper was saying exactly this, that the universes are just constantly generated out of a pre-existing space-time and there's no point at the beginning. So I think that all these things are on the table. We don't know the answers. You know, I used to, like a few years ago, I used to make statements when people would say, well, what about the Big Bang? I would say, well, you know, that's a boundary and laws of physics break down and so forth. Now I just say, well, we don't know. I'm more honest, because we just don't know, and who knows?
So we do know some things. For example, you said that we do know that the universe we're in now is expanding.
Yes.
And we can look at the galaxies in our telescopes and see, measure their velocities and their distances and see that the universe is expanding in all directions. So we may not know about all of these other universes and the multiverses and so on, but we do know that the universe that we're in is expanding.
And was much smaller and hot.
And was much, much smaller and denser and hotter than it is now.
One of the very important things to do is to impress people both with how much we do know and where the boundary is.
Yeah.
But what worries me, sorry.
Is just because I think there are a ton of questions from the audience. That's all. So I may Tony, let's go from right to left, I guess, because we have plenty of time. So
I actually want to defend Steve Weinberg, not that he needed me to defend him, but partly because I wanted to defend him because he has been very nice to me in both my career as a physicist and as a writer. He's the one who arranged for me to have lunch with his publisher in New York and got my career as a writer going. As far as I can remember, and I think my memory is still reasonably good, even at my age, I think what he said was not whether the universe has meaning. I think the exact quote is more like, the more we understand about the universe, the more pointless it seems.
Yeah, exactly.
And I actually want to ask the panelists, if you guys are so smart, what is the point of the universe?
I know that one. No, you go first. I just think he was right. There's no point except what we give it, which is not to be denigrated.
No, it's not. Yeah, I mean, you know, we're pretty interesting. We make great stories. We have this great imagination. That's.
Just because we're not at the center of the universe.
Define a point.
Just because we're not at the center of the universe doesn't mean we're not the most interesting bit of it.
Until we find another interesting bit, and then it'll be nice to compare. I think that's part of our problem in the human condition, is we have no other intelligence to compare ourselves. And I think that is going to be one of the most biggest revolutions for us if we ever do come in contact with another intelligence.
Can you tell us what the point of the universe is?
Well, they'll have their own point. They'll probably have their own point. We're all egocentric, aren't we? I mean, I think any intelligence, just by the very nature of evolution, we want to survive. We want to be our own center of our own universe in order to survive. So I think it's inbuilt into the human mechanism, that survival sense that makes us want to be the center of the universe, each and every one of us.
Yeah, Peter, yeah.
Can I go back, sort of tie this panel to the previous one, communication and understanding, and I was struck by your distinction between understanding through the equations and then understanding, and I wonder if you could talk a little more about, particularly to those of us who are not used to looking at the world through equations, exactly what the phrase understanding through the equations mean when it doesn't, even to your graduate students, immediately translate into that other kind of understanding that the rest of us mean by understanding.
Yeah, well, I think, okay, it's a fascinating question, and I think that yesterday there was some discussion of this fact that on the one hand, human beings did not evolve to become physicists, and therefore in some ways thinking about physics in the way that we're forced to think about it because of experiments comes unnaturally to us. On the other hand, we are part of the world, and therefore we're not completely divorced from it, and we do have some feeling for it. And so my very naive understanding is that there are intuitions that you build up about how things move in the universe, and you partially get trained out of them as a physicist, but you never completely let them go. And you know, I can tell my students as many times, I can write down the equations and I can say, look, in the solar system, it's not that the expansion of the universe is a small effect, it's really zero. You just can't notice it. And they're like, are you sure the planets aren't moving apart a little bit? I'm like, no, they're really not. And then I can show them the equations and they go, oh, okay. But they're still squinting at me like, I don't quite like it. And it's just because we don't think in equations. Pure and simple. We think sometimes in pictures, some people think in sort of formal structures and so forth. And there's a level of comfort that you get maybe with the equations themselves. There's a level of comfort that Ed Witten has with equations that I will never have, that enables him to see further in how this works. But at the end of the day, we're human beings understanding things as human beings, and that understanding is a little imperfect when compared to the purely mathematical understanding. It's not an answer to your question at all, but it's the set of words I can say.
Toby wants to do it.
This may reduce me to something way below those undergraduates, but taking up this note, it also may be intrusive as a personal question. But so many of these ideas, these immense ideas like the expanding universe, make me feel, since the equations don't enter into it in my mind at all, it's an emotional response. I mean, part of it is that feeling of like, oh, come back. You know, I guess, you know, I mean, it's just silly, but you know, whatever. You know, not come, but you know what I mean. It's that there's an emotional component to these immense ideas. Yeah. And of course you can, I mean, part of what you, Jana, seem to be describing so eloquently, you know, standing on the shore of the planet, and, is that physics has described scientifically what people have been responding to since long before there was a physics to describe it. I mean, the two central myths of the Western world, I mean, in Genesis and, say, Oedipus, are the quest for knowledge. And the quest for knowledge is the grandest enterprise a human being can embark on and also the most tragic. And that those two notions are inherently linked in the human condition. And so if what you're I guess what I'm really asking is how does it make you feel to know what you know about the universe, not from a scientific point of view, but from a human point of view? Or does that not, have you trained yourself out of that? I mean, in some way, I don't know if I could bear to do what you do, because I'm already upset just thinking about it.
Tell you, I know how Woody Allen feels about this. I don't know if you guys remember. I think it was Annie Hall, and he has this like nervous breakdown as a kid because he realizes the universe is expanding. And his mother says to him, "You know, what business is it of yours? You live in Brooklyn. Brooklyn is not expanding." You know. I think, you know, if you look at the story, and I'm sure many people know the story. Even Einstein did not want to accept this, and I think when he was told that his equations implied the expansion of the universe. It's a very well-known story that he introduced something called the cosmological constant to try to stop this expansion from happening. And he later called it his greatest blunder. And I think, you know, I'm sure I'm projecting, but not because it was his greatest mathematical error. He had a lot of struggles with the mathematics and non-Riemannian geometry, but because it was sort of a blunder of belief, you know, that he allowed what he believed and wanted to believe to alter his sort of scientific ideas. And so that's why it was such a huge blunder, because actually the cosmological constant is still very important in our theories. But so I kind of pushed your question off onto other people, how other people reacted. And yeah, I mean, I guess I've not
denying the tragic vision of
yeah,
it all.
I'm
very at home with that.
Yeah. I love a good tragic story, you know. And also, I have not trained myself out of it for sure. I can say that. And I think part of writing is just to indulge in that for a little while and to use plain English to talk about it. You know, when I sit with my colleagues and we're talking about finite universes, we say things like, you know, you take the manifold modulo, the diffeomorphism to the, you know, the Assam tree. I mean, it's ridiculous. And then only much later, when I start to have to explain it to my mom, can I say, you know, what we're really after is whether or not the universe is infinite. And even it hits me in the solar plexus in a totally different way than it did for the year and a half when I was calculating using three-dimensional topology. And I think that the writing, since that is the topic of the panel, is a way of sort of just expressing and indulging in that a little bit.
I mean, I love Jana's word bittersweet, and I'm totally going to steal that because it's so good. Because on the one hand, you're right. You know, you feel a little bit insignificant here in this big universe that doesn't really care about us at all. On the other hand, you can't help but be amazed at the fact that we can understand as much of it as we can. And I love using the example of Big Bang nucleosynthesis because it seems so prosaic, you know, turning protons and neutrons into helium. Okay, but what it means is that in the last 100 years, we went from being completely clueless about cosmology to being able to take a 14 billion year old universe and extrapolate it back to a time when the universe was 1 second old and make a prediction and get it exactly right. And to me, that's like the most profound fact in physics, that we understand what the universe was doing when it was 1 second old. What right do we have to understand that? But we do. So you take the good with the bad.
Oh, yeah. Wow. There'll be time for everybody. Well, I was doing this. Well, you'll be next, I promise. Okay.
You're talking about sort of cosmology and then creationism, but there's another competing system called astrology. And in some ways, you know, astrology is the big competitor. And when I once taught something on astrology and alchemy and mesmerism during a period at MIT, you have to ask yourself the question, why does two-thirds the population believe in astrology when our astronomy is so good? And I think it answers a little bit of your question. When you think about, I mean, I'll think about something closer like the sun. Right now on the sun, every second, 600 million tons of hydrogen are changing into 596 million tons of helium and 4 million tons, I'm going to use the English system, of mass is disappearing. Every second, 4 million tons by E equal MC squared. And this has been going on for 5 billion years and it's going to go on for another 5 billion years. And you tell me you got problems? I mean, in some ways, you know. So I think the ancient idea, now why? I'm just saying, no, but astrology is saying something to people, you know, when you're trying to understand, what are they really saying? What they're saying is, when I am born and another soul comes into the universe, the stars, the moon, the things pause for a moment to accept this new soul, and it matters. And in some sense, wow, that's also very appealing to an emotional thing. And so every time we physicists try to squash astrology, we're missing the point. And the point is, when you read your horoscope, and everyone says all the horoscopes are no good and all in all, but you read your horoscope, and what does it say today? It says, today, check your finances, call some old friends, and you know, look into this. That's about as good advice as you get from anybody. And if you followed that, your life would be perfectly fine. It's as rational as... So I think we're, you know, there's another point here, and it maybe answers your...
No, don't. Actually, I really feel I need to defend myself. I mean, if you're talking about a kind of tragic vision of the
of human existence, of the human condition, from a point of view of, say, literature, of creative work, you don't really simply I mean, that is so, that is the first time actually I have felt so patronized by a scientist at this conference. I mean, that feeling of like, oh, well, if you can't do the math, you really must be just a superstitious fool. And I think that really is unfair. I think people, if my access to the wonder of cosmology is emotional rather than mathematical, that seems legitimate, if not scientific. I'm sorry, I missed your point. I beg your pardon. Okay, I don't want to
help. Okay, so let's go somewhere else. Here, front row. We have a front row question here, please.
So you heard.
You need the mic.
Okay. Thank you. Well, you've heard from people's reactions what a compelling topic this is. It generates emotion, not just intellectual reaction. So it's incredibly important. This makes transistors look like pretty small potatoes. I really need to say that. This is big stuff. So I want to get back to what you raised, Sean. Why is it so damn hard to find good metaphors so that people can understand this deeply on all levels, with their heads as well as their hearts? And I want to throw out a thought to you and see if you and the panel has a reaction. A lot of the metaphors we use are visually based. You ask people to, you show them a balloon, you ask them to imagine the balloon. You said you go beyond that and say to the students, imagine yourself in a galaxy, watch the other galaxies flee away. I do that also. I teach cosmology as part of astronomy. All I get is blank incomprehension. I think there's a lack of ability to do visualization that is really prevalent among people in our society. I would almost describe it to computer games, actually, because you don't need a hell of a lot of visual imagination to do a computer game. What can we do to enhance visual understanding of some of the very abstract ideas you're talking about? Is there anything we can do at all? We can do a little bit in plays, we can do a little bit in performance. What can we do on the printed page or in the book?
So I don't know the answer. The only tiny suggestion I have is, as far as the universe is concerned, I mean, basically what I'm saying is we should perhaps stop visualizing the universe from outside, since there is no outside, as far as we know. I mean, there may be, but in the universe, part of the universe we understand, it doesn't need to be an outside, and visualize it from inside. And that should be as easy, I think. So I would love to see planetarium displays that show a picture of many, many galaxies, and then suddenly you say, okay, now get ready, and all the galaxies start shrinking. And you would get this feeling that the galaxies are moving away from you, and you say that's what the universe is like, everything is moving away from you, rather than drawing a picture of it as some, okay, here's the universe kind of thing. I don't know whether that helps or not. Sometimes you just need to do it 12 times in a row and they go, oh, okay, now I get it, you know? And we're all like that.
I want to bring in the fact that I think we have not a confusion. There is a difference between teaching physics and writing on physics. And my job is not to teach physics. I often will write a story because I know the initial audience is not picking that story up or picking this book up, or maybe they are. They want, you know, to actually learn physics. What I try as a science writer is to put people into, give them a sense of the physical process. That's why I think metaphors and analogies can be very important. That, okay, in this short 5,000 or 3,000 word article, I'm not going to teach physics, but I can allow this person to touch for a moment a sense of what it's like to have an enlightening moment on understanding a physical process. And I think that can be as important in communicating to a wider audience than, and but I think, I mean, certainly teaching, say in a museum setting, something of that nature, a NOVA special, bringing in those visuals to actually teach the physics can be very important. But at the same time, I think we also have to have those moments where you at least want to give people a chance to get a sense of the beauty of the physical process. And that's where I think the raisin bread or the balloon or whatever, they at least get a sense of a picture to think about that they can take away, maybe think a little more deeply, go to a physics book maybe if they have a further curiosity. But I don't know if our total, and I'm speaking as a science writer, I don't think that's my job. I don't want to teach people inertia, you know, thermodynamics, electromagnetic equations, but I do want to give them a sense of how the processes work through nature. And so a scientist may not be perfectly at ease with that, but if I can get somebody to appreciate and think and have an emotional response, I believe an emotional response is very important. Mm-hmm. I would feel like I have succeeded if I got someone to read my piece and have an emotional response to it and have an aha moment. Oh, that makes sense to me. I get a little understanding now of what that means. So, I don't know, I think we need both.
Well, yeah. Just one last comment. I agree with what you say. I strive for that in my writing too, but if people are worried that someday there'll be textbooks with stickers that say relativity is just a theory, as we're now seeing with Darwinian evolution, then you need to worry about the teaching side too, as well as the aha moment. It all has to come together.
It's already
there. Yeah.
Sure, go ahead. I was going to make a comment. It's just going back to Peter's question, may tie this up a little, which is you're asking about this feeling of the equation and understanding. And I thought of a simple analogy, which is, if you're a musician, since you like music, you know, and you can write a score and you can read a score and you look at the score, you have an immediate understanding, if you're really good, right, of what the music piece is about, you know. And it's the same kind of feeling with equations, you know. We look at the equations and we have this immediate understanding, if you know what you're talking about, you know, of what they mean and how they, and in the same way that you do not have to be a musician to appreciate the beauty of a composition or the structure of the composition, the same role is played in a sense by the science writing that informs, not forms, informs people about the beauty of the scientific theories.
Can I just undermine that analogy just a little bit? Mm-hmm. It seems to me that when you look at the score and you have that understanding, mm-hmm. that is absolutely consonant with the understanding that you get when you actually listen to the music. And what I thought Sean was saying was that the understanding he gets from the equations and the understanding, at least for his graduate students, that they understand in that other way, don't quite mesh. Mm-hmm. And then when you step back to that other thing, they say, I understand the equations, but...
Yeah, no, I kind of like Marcello's analogy, yeah. Because, you know, have you had the experience of listening to compositions by recent musical school graduates that were perhaps very technically accomplished yet missed some of the underlying emotional impact that you could get from someone who knew less? I mean, these are two different types of understanding, and I can enjoy, you know, a jazz piece without knowing what key it is in. And I would claim that I could know what key it was in without perhaps understanding its emotional impact quite as well. Or both. But I think it's a very similar...
Benny, I'm sorry, there was a question there first, Benny. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I am interested in metaphors, but remember Flatland, it was mentioned earlier, and basically the lesson that came out of that, it was to explore dimensionality. And it starts with lying land, goes to flat land, but you're living in the reader is living in a three-dimensional. And the lesson that comes out of that is you step up one dimension, you can see the insides of the previous inhabitants. Now, to extrapolate that to see the fourth dimension, if I was looking at any of you, I think I saw an artist do a picture of this. It was a body turned inside out with the whole universe inside. I don't know that that's helpful.
Yeah, it's not clear that three-dimensional skin is going to completely encompass us if we are 4, 5, 6, 7 dimensions.
We have a three-dimensional brain. I don't know if we even have the capability of imagining what 4, 5, 6 dimensions are. We're limited, just as the Flatlanders would absolutely be. They could not conceive of a third dimension.
Even when they were in it.
And wouldn't get it because that wasn't their work.
It wouldn't in the
Oh, Ed Whitten. Okay. Well,
David is shaking his head there. Do you want to make a point, David? Come on. Let me put you on the spot here a sec.
People forget that at the end of that book, the guy who was claiming the existence of extra dimensions was thrown in jail.
Yeah. Was persecuted.
Prediction of things to come?
Let's see what David has to say.
My point, the reason I was shaking my head was that I have no problem seeing any number of dimensions, as most of us who know, you know, who are acquainted with mathematical formalism can do. That mathematics is a way of seeing and of picturing, and it's as real as vision or touch or smell. But it's a sense that many people are blind to, which is unfortunate. And it's very hard then to describe to people who don't have that sense what it means. Like, it's hard to describe to a blind or a deaf person what smell or sound are. But for, you know, those of us who are schooled in mathematics and stare at equations or think of equations every day for hours, we acquire a sixth sense. Just using that sense alone, you can picture many things that are impossible to describe using the other senses alone. To be sure, they're somewhat poorer than they are when they're combined with the other sense. So it's nice to have many to hear and see at the same time, or touch and smell. But the equations, or the mathematics by itself, is a very rich sense, sensory perception, and using that, four dimensions, five, six, a million.
What's the idea?
Easy.
It's true.
Can I just come back to Sydney's question very quickly, and something David also brought up about the visualization. For about 9 months, I was teaching in an art school, which is a crazy thing to do. Yeah, I was a scientist in residence at the art school. I don't even have a point to make, but it was very interesting to talk about visualizations and to see their approach to visualizations, because artists are much more ingenious. They're not just trying to do a literal representation of a three-dimensional manifold. I mean, they'll start to think in a very deep way about symbolism, about what it means to invent graphs that might represent in some deeper way the analogy. And it was really quite amazing to watch them. They weren't even interested in the traditional trying to literally visualize, because that's their whole challenge as contemporary artists, is to kind of get away from that. So I don't know, it's not really a point.
Did that affect you as a writer? Did you come away with any lessons that you've applied to your writing?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure. I mean, it was recently. It was only a year ago that I did it, so maybe I'm still... Ask me again in a year.
Any questions?
Bailey,
that's right.
Something that you said in the panel the other day that was making me think, you were talking about how because science describes nature and the reality, that's one of the things that makes it a good thing for artists to use as metaphor. And I was just thinking that in the other direction, it might also hinder your teaching a little bit. Because science describes reality and nature, there's this assumption that it can be explained by... through reality and nature, that can be explained by things that we can imagine and feel and see and touch. And in the arts, we're very used to teaching things that have no physical reality outside of of our mental constructs of them. And it's interesting, because in teaching the arts, it's we use metaphors, but nobody ever thinks literally that these things are actually represent what's actually happening. It's obviously always a metaphor, and that in the teaching of the arts is fundamentally experiential. In other words, I think of myself as a playwriting teacher, as a music teacher. In other words, I can explain music theory all day long, but ultimately they have to practice the piano if they want to learn how to do it. And I was thinking that in physics, I don't know, this is maybe the same way, that ultimately maybe the learning of physics is an experiential exercise and not a intellectual exercise, and it's like practicing the piano.
Yeah, at some level you can't be taught some things. You have to sit down and work through them privately and work through that math until you develop that intuition. It's not something... I've never known anyone who passively receives physics any more than anyone passively receives language and suddenly starts being conversational.
Right. And definitely maybe there's no way to fully understand it beyond having that experience.
Yeah, and it requires both. You need to be trained, and like we said, it's not something you're born to do. And And there's this fact that you can begin to understand at the level of equations and so forth without still being able to translate it back into other terms. And, you know, Feynman once famously said that if he couldn't give a lecture on something at the level of a freshman physics class, then he didn't understand it, right? And that's part of the struggle you undergo.
And sometimes calculating is the easiest thing. It's just the hard part is trying to figure out what you just calculated and to try to interpret what the implications might be. And I think that's also where you see a lot of people make mistakes. And very few people make calculational errors. You know, people are pretty good, sophisticated. It's that they have mistakes of interpretation, what their calculation meant.
It makes me think of Dirac, who worked out his the 1930s, was the first to apply the special theory of relativity with quantum mechanics, and lo and behold, saw a very unusual result coming out, that you could have an electron, but you could have this doppelganger, an electron that looked exactly like an electron, except it had all the opposite properties. He had the bravery to decide to predict, the very, very first theorist, actually, to predict a new form of matter strictly from equations, and 1 year later it was discovered.
Yeah, Marcel is shaking his hand because he was not as brave as you're making it out to be.
First.
He did think it was a proton.
Like a proton.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like Einstein blinked with the expanding universe.
All right.
So it's a perfect example of not being good at interpreting.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Even the great Dirac, right?
But I guess when they discovered in the cosmic ray experiment in the cloud chamber, they saw the particle, and then it all came together.
It was just a few years. It was 29 when he did it, 32, I think, was discovered.
The first piece of antimatter.
So it was just a few years later, but close, you know.
I wanted to go back to the idea about the bittersweet quality of some of this understanding and ask a question and see whether it's connected to some of the later discussion about understanding through equations and so on. And it's probably a question that kind of reflects my own limitations, but I think with the bittersweet quality of sort of recognizing insignificance and also somehow understanding there's something kind of amazing about being able to recognize that insignificance, I get to that point, and then I think I see another dimension, which is also saying, like, and as I go on with my life, I'm also having this kind of understanding separate from a lot of what I do as I go on with my life. That is, it operates as a kind of faith about, okay, this is my position in the universe, or this is my understanding about you know, some of these concepts that I can get to a certain point of understanding scientifically, but don't seem to have direct kind of consequences for what I do day to day, or even Anthony's idea about the you know, Russian roulette for people who believe in multiple universes. There seems to be a little bit of a disconnect, but that's also part of the this there's a little twist there, and I guess I want to ask people who do this all the time whether they do something like that, or if in fact that, I guess part of what I'm saying is that it seems to me then that there's this kind of element of faith to this explanation, even if it's based on science, because it doesn't seem to have all that many, you know, immediate consequences. And so it's really kind of a question about, is there this other consequence beyond the kind of cognitive and to some extent emotional point of understanding with this bittersweet double vision. I'm not even sure I articulated that very well. So if it doesn't make sense, we could just move on.
I think that has to be our sort of existential, desperate closing remark, because I see the organizer there telling that it's time for us to close. So I'd like to thank the panel again. Thank you.
I saw that sign before, mate. I was trying to tell you in case you had something.